From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. What do borders mean in a globalized world? It's a question that Yasmin Khan asked herself as she explored the rich history and flavors of the Eastern Mediterranean while writing her latest cookbook, Ripe Figs.
Turkey is now the biggest recipient of refugees in the world. You know, 3.6 million refugees were housed there last year. We can say that in the US, it was just 122,000 people. So, you know, when politicians try and say that we have issues in the West, it's, you know, when you compare it to that region, it's not the same at all.
Before she turned to food writing, Yasmin studied law and campaigned for human rights. In Ripe Figs, her latest book, she focuses her lens on Turkey, Cyprus, and Greece, where she ate with ordinary people, both refugees and locals, and found herself incredibly moved to see the hospitality that individuals from all countries extend to each other at the table. Hi, Yasmin.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, it's always so wonderful to be able to have a conversation with you. So I guess we should start with the geographic area. When you refer to the Eastern Mediterranean, what countries are you including?
So for the purpose of this cookbook, I'm talking about Greece, Turkey, and Cyprus. Although the borders of the Eastern Mediterranean can go a little wider, I wanted to pick those countries because I think they've got a fluidity in their cuisine and have historically had a fluidity in their borders.
Because they were all parts of the Ottoman Empire at one point.
They were. And for 400 years, the Ottoman Empire probably had the most significant culinary influence throughout that whole region. But more than that, you know, when we go back over several millennia, you know, this is a region where the ancient Greeks were, you know, had empires, where the Venetians, the Romans, the Persians, all kind of saw their empires roam through. So it's got this incredible history as well. And you see those similarities that are woven from the history on people's dining tables.
When did you first travel to the area?
Well, a long time ago now. So many decades ago, I can't put a number on it. But I think about 30 years ago, I traveled there with my family. I went to Turkey for one of our kind of summer vacations. And it was just a magical, you know, summer holiday. And I, you know, some of my fondest memories of that trip are kind of gazing out onto the shimmering turquoise blue waters of the Aegean Sea and tucking into delicious grilled fish kebabs and, you know, drinking, tangy and sharp sour cherry juice. And I just fell in love with the food and really became enamored with Turkish cuisine and Turkish culture.
So how do the memories of that sort of idyllic trip reconcile with your more recent visits?
Well, you know, what I try and do with my work and my cookbooks is to take, you know, readers on a journey that, yes, explores the celebratory aspects of what we eat and the recipes we share, but also doesn't shy away from some of the harsher realities. And I wanted to explore this region because, you know, in the last 6 years, it's gone through a huge shift with the biggest movement of people since the Second World War coming in to the area, mostly, you know, remnants or after effects of the Syrian Civil War and the wars on Iraq and Afghanistan. So as someone who's increasingly become interested in borders and migration and kind of felt quite challenged and conflicted by the political narratives that have been taking place on both sides of the Atlantic, I wanted to go there to explore, you know, what this migration had done in the region, and also what borders and identity mean in an increasingly interconnected world.
One of the elements of the book that I find so interesting is how you freely interpret traditional recipes, which I think is a marvelous thing. So let's just jump into a recipe for a minute to use as an example. Could you talk about the smoky lima beans?
Absolutely. So Gigantes Palaki is a very traditional Greek dish made with lima beans that that are cooked in a tomato-based sauce that's then baked in the oven. It's a wonderful dish and I absolutely love it. And I'm a big advocate for cooking beans from scratch, but I fully appreciate not everyone has the time to do that. So my version of the dish uses canned beans and it's cooked on the stove. And I kind of up the paprika element because I love, you know, sweet paprika and smoked paprika. And it's just an incredibly easy, you know, midweek dinner that you can, you know, get on the table in less than half an hour, but just can transport you, I think, to the sunny shores of the Mediterranean.
Yeah, just looking through your book, I was reminded of that. And I also was reminded that part of my pandemic pantry is about 2 pounds of those kind of dry beans. So I will be making that dish quite soon. And let's talk about breakfast, because breakfast in that part of the world has to be one of my favorites, I have to say.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, the Turkish breakfast is truly one of the most exquisite meals that someone can have. It is an assortment of dishes, hot and cold, from, you know, maybe eggs done with some either pastrami or some sucuk, which is a spicy sausage, or perhaps eggs in like a beautiful yogurt, poached in yogurt with like chili butter. So you'll always have some eggs. Then you'll have some fresh vegetables, some cucumbers, some tomatoes, some olives, a few different types of cheeses, obviously the kind of the feta from the region, the white cheese that's known very well. But, you know, also perhaps, just a kind of 3 or 4 different selections of cheeses. There'll always be some jams and really interesting jams, you know, not just like a strawberry jam, but perhaps a carrot jam or a rose petal jam. And then my personal favorite is slabs of honey and honeycomb, and alongside it, kaimak, which is... it's a cream, a bit like the British clotted cream, but that's kind of made from buffalo milk, and it's really rich and creamy. And yeah, all of this stuff with some bread and tahini. Oh my word. It's like you have it for breakfast and you don't need to eat for the rest of the day.
Which is really too bad because there's so much other great food.
Yeah, I know.
So speaking of tahini, one of your recipes is for these beautiful flaky tahini swirls.
Yes. This is something that's very common in all three countries, Greece, Turkey, and Cyprus, with each country having their own variation on it. So they're sweet pastries made with an enriched dough, and you weave a sugar and tahini mix in between the layers of pastry so that after it cooks, it's kind of slightly crisp and the sweet tahini is just layered throughout it. Yeah, I mean, it's an essential accompaniment is a cup of, you know, coffee, preferably a black coffee from the region. But I absolutely love it. And I made so many of them during the early days of the lockdown, actually, last year. It became my go-to.
One of the ingredients I think of as being sort of sprinkled throughout the region is halloumi, with its sort of wonderful salty bite and very particular texture. How is it used in different places?
Yeah, halloumi is a very popular cheese. I think it's incredibly popular at breakfast time, just classically, you know, just fried and served with some bread and chopped tomatoes. But it's also used in a whole manner of ways, which, you know, were quite new to me. In Cyprus, for example, they do an incredible halloumi and mint ravioli, which just, yeah, pasta shapes, kind of stuffed with this incredible, you know, cheese and mint. It's also used in breads. So there are great olive and halloumi breads that are made in Cyprus. And Cyprus claims that it's the home of halloumi. And yeah, given the amount of dishes that they have with it in, that doesn't surprise me.
And what I love, too, about how you describe the way you travel through this region is you own up to the fact that not every single dish is some Instagram-ready, gorgeous thing, but you can find comfort and deliciousness where you least expect it. So one of the, what you say, stumble-upon dishes that you found was the black-eyed peas with chard.
Oh, gosh. I mean, even just remembering the first time I ate that, I'm just, yeah, in awe. You know, I just stumbled out of the bus station at Nicosia Central, and that's the capital of Cyprus. And there was just a really busy cafe on the corner, and I was really hungry. And I was like, right, I'll just go there. And I, you know, I saw that everybody was ordering the same dish. So I just, you know, ordered, you know, pointed to what people were having and said, I'll have one of those. And I didn't know it at the time, but this is a very kind of famous summer dish in Cyprus, which is cooked black-eyed beans. They're cooked with some fresh chard, or you could use kind of any wild greens, and then doused in lots of garlic and lemon and olive oil. And it just, it was so simple, but it just really, for me, encapsulated the truth that is that when you get fresh food in season that's locally grown, it really just needs some olive oil and lemon and garlic, and all of a sudden it's one of the most exquisite meals ever.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for taking the time to spend with us.
It's always a pleasure, Evan. I hope to see you in person sometime again soon.
Me too. That was Yasmin Khan, the author of Zaytoun. Her latest book is Ripe Figs. It's an ode to the migrant experience and a testament to the solace brought by food and its familiarity. When we return, California is once again experiencing a drought, and those gorgeous yellow mustard flowers you see growing on the hillsides right now, well, they do not bode well for fire season. One master gardener has tips on how to harvest those plants and put them to good use.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Good Food. Last week, a friend of mine posted a glorious video to Instagram of her little boy running on a footpath bordered by walls of yellow mustard flowers. Reveling in the beauty, I forgot to ask myself how the mustard got there or if there was a downside to it all. Then I opened this beautiful zine from Alyssa Khan and Nadine Allen titled Wild Mustard, A Guide in the Age of Wildfires, and everything I wanted to know was there, illustrated. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, Evan.
What a beautiful little zine this is, put together in such a lovely way.
Thank you. Nadine did all of the art and she's amazing.
Yeah, it's quite beautiful. Why look at mustard? What does it have to tell us?
Mustard has a complicated history as far as how it got here and then what it's doing now, which is really threatening biodiversity and outcompeting California natives. Mustard produces chemicals that inhibit seed germination in the wake of fire damage. And then once dry, the mustard becomes tinder for wildfire. The main threat is that mustard is an annual plant, so it dries up at the end of the season. And when it's dry and just has proliferated everywhere, it can really easily catch on fire and that fire can spread. So when I look at mustard, I think of all the ways that it could be put to use rather than sitting around to, you know, become dry and turn into tinder for wildfires.
So what can we do about it? When we see all this mustard in a field, should we pull our car over to the side of the road and leap out and start harvesting it?
I'd say yes.
Is there a better way to harvest it than not? Should we be pulling it out by the roots because it's such an invasive species?
You know, you can, but it won't grow back. If you cut it at the base, it leaves the roots in the soil to contribute nutrients to the soil biology once it breaks down.
And it won't grow back?
Correct.
Is there a particular variety we need to look for? Are there several different wild mustards that we have a problem with here in California?
There are many different types of wild mustards, but the one that we mainly see around is the one that we're looking for, the Brassica nigra or black mustard. You can tell by its yellow flowers that have four petals on them. It used to be part of a plant family called the Cruciferaceae family, now called the Brassica family.
And so let's talk about all the things we could do with it, because it's really impressive. So many things we can do. And it seems like now is a great time to harvest, right?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, so definitely we know we can use it for food, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But what really intrigues me are these other uses that I never really thought about before. So what is like a home use for it?
One of the home uses for mustard is to make a powder, which can act as a dishwasher or a deodorizer to get rid of the odor from food residues, and also to be a dishwashing solution.
And what part of the plant do we use to make a powder from?
That we use the seeds, and we grind them up.
Wow, how interesting. And do you just do it in a blender?
You can use like an electric coffee grinder or a mortar and pestle.
Okay, so the next one I'm going to ask you about really intrigues me, and that is paper.
Yeah, we actually made some paper ourselves to test it out. Mustard has really strong cellulose fiber, and so we're able to make a paper out of it using a mold and a deckel.
What is a deckel?
Yeah, it's a frame that then has a fine mesh screen placed inside of it.
And what is the quality of the paper, and what is the color? What does it look like?
The paper is a little bit pulpy, a little bit thick, and the color, I believe, is kind of like a washed out green.
So we have paper. I understand that we can also use the mustard to make an ink. How do you do that?
It's not too difficult. You just need some mustard flowers as well as the ground seeds, water, vinegar, salt, and gum arabic.
And you mentioned that it can be used as fertilizer. So can it be used as fertilizer beyond what happens in a compost pile?
Yeah, it can be tilled directly back into the soil, because of its nutritionally dense composition. And once it's in the soil, it also acts as a biofumigant, which is one of the other uses that we mentioned for mustard. And I first came across mustard as a biofumigant when I was farming in Santa Cruz, and we had issues with something called the root knot nematode. And we used a mustard meal to till into the soil to try to eradicate the pest problem.
That's so interesting. So do you make your own mustard? And if so, do you have a recipe that you can share with us?
I have made my own mustard. The recipe calls for a half cup of mustard seeds, a half cup of beer, a third cup of water, 3 tablespoons apple cider vinegar, and 1 tablespoon of maple syrup. You just combine those in a bowl and let it stand for 2 to 3 days. And then after that time, you pour it in a blender and blend it until smooth with a little bit of graininess, and then add some water if the mustard is too thick.
So if we have the mustard, how do we get the seeds out of it? Is it difficult?
No, it's not too difficult. If you have a lot of mustard, you can either rub it between your hands or against a surface that will cause the seed pods to break open. And then when you have a lot of it, you can put it on a tarp and like step on it, and then the seeds will dislodge. And then from there, you do screen and winnowing process. So similarly with a mesh screen inside of a frame. So we're blowing the chaff from the grain.
Thank you so much, Alyssa.
Thank you, Evan.
Alyssa Kahn is a master gardener and fruit tree specialist. Together with artist Nadine Allen, she created a beautiful zine on wild mustards. It's a free download, and we'll have a link to it on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Nature is the ultimate metaphor, and mushrooms may be the ultimate teachers. The more one learns about fungi, the more one realizes that they may be the portal to the secret of life. Doug Bierend went in search of Mycotopia, the name of his new book, and found citizen science, fungi fanatics, and the untapped potential of mushrooms. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Evan.
Mycologist Juliana Ferci refers to fungi as the egg in the cake. What exactly does she mean by that?
She does, and I love that imagery. It's so evocative, and also I think it conveys a lot about what fungi do. On one hand, it's a pretty literal representation of what you might find in the soil and the forest, especially where fungi are generally the most prolific and diverse. They are webbed within the soil, usually eating leaf litter, logs, other, you know, insects, other microbes and fungi. They are decomposers that facilitate the churning of life in ecosystems throughout the planet. And they do that as webs that connect things. So in that sense, they do sort of resemble the way egg kind of skeins out and holds cake together. And they do that for soil. They also prevent erosion by doing that, but they also connect things in a more figurative sense, no less real, but more in the sense of facilitating connections between different orders of life and different kingdoms. They connect trees together in relationships that are often called the wood wide web. So there are many ways to kind of interpret them as in the mix.
What do you think is the most fundamentally powerful aspect of this extraordinary kingdom?
Well, you know, I think for most people, it might just be the discovery of it in the first place. You know, to take the forest again as an example, if you were to walk into the forest and not notice the trees or the plants at all, or you weren't to notice the animals, that's a pretty fundamental dimension of the forest that you'd be missing. And fungi are a kingdom of life just as important, just as diverse and widespread. They're ubiquitous, really. So the fact that they aren't visible to us, you know, except for their mushrooms, which are just how they reproduce, means that when you really start to look into what they are and learn about their functions and their ubiquity, you soon recognize that they are everywhere and that you've missed a fairly large part of the picture when it comes to the living world.
To me, they're so odd. It's almost as if they are the alien species among us, and we can't grasp them because there's something elusive about them and yet deeply metaphorical, as you've said.
Yeah, and there's a strong urge among some people to credit them with extraterrestrial, you know, origin because they're so uncanny and strange. And many people theorize that they came from space. You know, the spores came from some other planet. I actually find it much more compelling to recognize them as relatives of ours, and you know, every other living thing is connected through the process of evolution. And you know, genetic sequencing has revealed that they are antecedents of animals, but came after plants.
I understand that they are generally underreported, simply because they're not as easily documented as animals and plants. Do we even know how many species of mushrooms are there?
No. We don't know what we don't know when it comes to fungi. There's a vast gap. They estimate that we know less than 10% of the total number of fungi in the world.
Let's talk about lost species of mushrooms. Can you tell us who's leading that work and what the process is for making discoveries?
Sure. I mean, it's not all that unlike what the Victorian era looked like when it comes to documenting plants and animals. And again, with the emergence of new technologies, you know, the microscope, for example, there were clubs forming that eventually helped to give rise to naturalist societies or institutions of science that sort of housed the knowledge that was gathered by these groups and then started undertaking their own research. And those institutions, up until quite recently, ignored fungi for the same reasons that many people have. You know, there are cultural reasons. They weren't recognized as distinct kingdom of life until 1969. Before that, they were considered a subset of plants. And so one of the mycologists I spoke to for my book described mycology as undergoing its own Victorian revolution today, where people are going out into the field with armed with new techniques and new technologies to actually find and differentiate these fungi. And those are being fed into various databases, housed at universities that are starting to open up what are called fungariums, places to house the specimens of fungi. There's a massive one at Kew Gardens in London, which goes back to sort of the original formation of these societies when they were mostly documenting plants and animals. But then as now, or now as then, the involvement of amateurs, so-called, is a massive part of the picture as well. So you have, you know, somewhat marginal figures, these scientists in institutions who are mycologists. You know, there's not usually a building with mycology written on it. They work with communities of enthusiasts who go out and are often as knowledgeable as anyone in these institutions about fungi and can go out and generate actual like genetic code sequences to send to these institutions. And so there are various partnerships emerging between mainstream capital S scientific institutions and these mycology groups, whether they are through mycological associations or just forays organized by people who work at these institutions, like Bryn Dentinger in Utah, who leads his students out as a curator of mycology at the Natural History Museum there, but also as a professor of biology. He takes his students into the field as a biology professor, and the specimens they collect, he brings back, and any interesting finds, he submits to the fungarium at the museum. So people who want to build out the picture of fungal biodiversity are finding a way, much like life finds a way, I guess.
You know, for years, I've read stories and watched countless YouTube videos about future applications of mycelia, from replacing plastics to killing termites to remediating tainted soil. And it seems that one of the biggest impediments to a true breakthrough in these fields is the fear of entrepreneurs to be truly entrepreneurial. This open source nature of mycological exploration, the way it meets capitalism, is that a problem?
No more than I would say capitalism itself is a problem. And in my view, that is no small problem. But I think that, yeah, there's a value system and a worldview that I encountered among many of the people sort of tinkering with fungi, getting to know them and find ways of working with them, inspired largely by a lot of these developments that you named, you know, the discoveries of their abilities to tie up heavy metals in soils or to break down certain contaminants in water. They pose a lot of very interesting opportunities for sustainable materials, and like packing foam is being replaced by mycelium, which is very interesting and promising. But, you know, I see all these things as maybe necessary, but probably insufficient to really meet the problems that I think we all are hoping to see solved. I guess to me, the hope I see in fungi is that they are bringing people together in ways that center other values than just accumulation. And I feel like there's a tension there between people who see a lot of economic opportunity in fungi, and rightly so. I don't bemoan or begrudge anybody trying to advance these mycotechnologies, but it's less exciting to me than the fact that people seem to be finding a way to gather around fungi and have conversations about broader issues. And inherent to that, into those conversations, I think, is a questioning of the profit motive, of accumulation, of what we're really learning from this emerging relationship with fungi.
Thank you so much. Your book is so dense with information and ideas, and it's so radical in a place that many people would not expect to find those kinds of conversations.
Well, thanks for saying that. And yeah, I think it's testament to just how, if it seems radical, if, you know, these people who are practicing what seem to be sustainable, equitable, you know, practices and developing a deeper relationship with nature and, you know, putting that first, you know, ahead of accumulation and whatnot, comes off as radical. And I think it does. It's only because of how radically out of whack the status quo is. So I'm glad to hear that it's resonating.
Well, thank you so much, Doug.
Thank you.
That's Doug Bierend. We've been discussing the human connections to fungi and mushrooms. His book is In Search of Mycotopia. In a minute, pivot, pivot, and pivot again. How one restaurant stayed afloat through their willingness to evolve. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Pivot, pivot, and then pivot again. That's been the theme for many restaurants this past year, but one family-owned business stands out. Yang's Kitchen became a neighborhood and media darling in Alhambra when it opened in 2019. But the restaurant business is fickle, and despite the acclaim, ingredient and labor expenses still proved to be a heavy burden. The pandemic both forced and allowed Chef Chris Yang to take a step back and retool the business a few times before finally reopening with new dishes, a brunch menu, and an 18-seat patio. He's here for this week's segment of In the Weeds.
Hi, I'm Chris Yang. I'm the chef and owner of Yang's Kitchen in Alhambra. Yang's Kitchen is really, at its core, an Asian-American restaurant. You know, a lot of people said we were Taiwanese in the beginning because, you know, we were cooking a lot of comfort foods that we grew up eating, and, you know, a lot of them happened to resemble Taiwanese foods, but really, since day one, we've really been an Asian-American restaurant. Opening Yang's Kitchen was always a dream of Maggie and mine. Maggie is my girlfriend of a long time. You know, it's just something that we were always really passionate about and something that we always really wanted to do and something we dreamed of for a long, long time. We knew that, you know, we were opening in the San Gabriel Valley, which had a lot of really, really affordable mom and pop Asian restaurants. And, you know, by all means, a lot of them are great. And we kind of told ourselves when we were coming in, like based on our price point, you know, we kind of had to differentiate ourselves, you know, and we were really deliberate about that actually with like the communication of our menu, kind of pointing out farmers and producers and suppliers that we sourced from. I think, you know, that was a deliberate choice in that regard to kind of signal to people that, hey, you know, we're trying to do something different here. At the same time, you know, the foods are familiar, but, you know, we kind of need to justify the higher prices. I'm not sure where the perception that Chinese food should be cheap came from. You know, I think a lot of it is, you know, when Asians themselves kind of think of home and they think of all the delicious foods that they ate at home. And, you know, oftentimes at home, I'm calling home Asia, like Hong Kong or China or even Taiwan. Oftentimes those foods, you can find them for like $2-3 US on the street. And, you know, I think that kind of skews a lot of people's perspectives. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, you know, overhead is different over there. Labor is different over there. The taxes, food costs, everything's different. So, you know, it's really apples to oranges. And, you know, when you come to America, maybe people bring that perception back with them. But I don't really think, I don't really see that as the case, that Chinese food should be cheap. So as of last spring, you know, our media attention had kind of reached its peak and every day was kind of crazy, which was, you know, in itself, it was a blessing because we were busy, but also at the same time, it was pretty much madness for us, trying to keep up, you know, with all the prep and, you know, doing this while our food costs and labor costs were really high. But, you know, all of a sudden, really quickly, you know, in March, business dropped off and then, you know, things got shut down. So things changed really, really fast. When, you know, Governor Newsom announced the shutdowns, Maggie and I, and also our other partners at the time, you know, we hopped on a phone call and we were like, what should we do? You know, like, you know, our business at the time was already struggling because we were trying to reach profitability, but, you know, was still having a hard time managing that. And just we were looking forward and said, you know, with just takeout, like, we didn't think there was any way that that would make things better. So we, you know, out of the concern for safety and health, our first decision was to just shut everything down and kind of regroup and think about what to do. I think COVID caused us to pivot probably 4 or 5 times, but I think after like the first or second time, we kind of looked at it more as like experiments and gathering data, you know, like seeing what we could do seeing what works for the business. It kind of became habitual at one point, and it was kind of fun. I mean, it's really tiring and stressful, but it got to the point where it's like, you know, this is probably the best time to experiment with the restaurant. So the first pivot we made was we reopened as a grocery store, and, you know, we were relying heavily on the farmer's market because, you know, our restaurant is physically located about like 100 meters from the Alhambra's farmer's market. And that was really a blessing because we made a lot of good relationships with the farmers there during that time. And we keep a lot of those elements to this day. We still offer some groceries and, you know, we try to use as much as those farmers' produce in our food as possible. A few other pivots we did were, you know, we tried different types of meals at different price points. First of all, some of it was out of necessity because, you know, we had like 3 people on staff. So we had to make meals that, you know, we could prepare with 2 or 3 of us versus like a whole team in the kitchen. So one of the first ones we produced was a roast chicken dinner that was kind of based loosely on like a Hainan chicken rice. For Mother's Day, I think, of 2020, we decided to try out a prime rib meal for like as a special family meal to go. The story behind that was that every Thanksgiving we have a huge family gathering and I always do prime ribs every year. And, you know, our whole family loves it. So, you know, we just said, hey, what the heck, you know, let's just try it for Mother's Day because it's a special holiday. And, you know, at that time, I think we were offering meals for like $50 per person, which was, you know, kind of a staggering amount for us because before that, our check averages were probably like $10 to $15 to $20 max per person. And yeah, that meal, I mean, it sold really fast and it sold really well. And we were just kind of amazed and wowed. So this time when we reopened, we revamped the concept a little bit. It's also basically, this is also another pivot that we're doing and, you know, just experimenting with more things and gathering more data. So we started like a brunch program. One of our ideas was to offer Eastern and Western breakfast. So our Eastern or our Asian breakfast idea is kind of inspired loosely by, you know, Japanese breakfast. You know, it comes with rice, miso soup, seasonal fish or tofu and seasonal vegetables. It's a fun breakfast that, you know, a lot of Asian cultures eat. You know, it's totally different from your standard Western breakfast. But, you know, at the same time, I grew up here in America, so we love the Western breakfast. So we also offer steak and eggs, breakfast plates, even our spin on pancakes, which has been really popular, is our cornmeal mochi pancakes. With the cornmeal, you know, you get bits of crunch throughout. And then with the mochi, it's not super chewy like boba per se, but it kind of gives it kind of like a mochi butter cake springiness. So it's kind of like a chewy, crispy pancake all in one.
Chris Yang is the owner of Yang's Kitchen in Alhambra. They're now open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Thursday through Monday. New York Times food editor Sam Sifton defined Dude Food as, quote, a cuisine that sits at the intersection of stoner and tailgate, unquote. Food-based gender stereotypes are constricting, detrimental, and often demeaning. Think of the meat and potatoes kind of guy versus women with their salads and diet soft drinks. Dr. Emily Contois is a professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa and examines the confluence of food marketing and gender in her work, Diners, Dudes, and Diets. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Evan. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, when we saw this book, we knew you were made for us. Let's start by talking about the word dude. Where did it originate, and what is a modern dude's relationship with his body?
Dude has an almost 100-year history when we think about the dude ranches of the late 19th century, places where men of means went to try and reclaim their masculinity that they were worried was fading away when they were in urban environments, sort of moved away from, you know, really active jobs and sort of experiences with the land. But the kind of dude that I'm writing about probably has its closest origins in the 60s and 70s when we think about surfer, druggy cultures. This is the slacker. This is is tuning out, dropping out, and sort of having this much more relaxed sort of approach to how to be a man, how to move through the world, and how to think about your body. So as I analyzed the dude, I also thought about dad bod, this media phenomenon that comes out in about 2015, describing a male body that's still, you know, productive and does things, and still goes to the gym, still works out, but he does not have a six pack. He is not lean. He enjoys drinking an entire six pack and a whole pizza to himself. So I'm interested in how that celebration of the slacker came to be a motif that we saw in food media and marketing in the 21st century.
So how has the masculine body ideal changed over time? And how has men's media adapted to that evolution?
So similarly, the 19th century is a really interesting moment where so much about American life changes. And so at first, when we think of things like diet culture, the concerns about the male body, particularly the white male body and its authority, its strength, those circulate in both medical and sort of fashion communities as we think about men's bodies. Men's bodies shift from being sort of a bit plump as a sign of their class status to one that's expected to be rigorous and strong. The origins of bodybuilding and strongman competitions, for example, all come out of that sort of turn of the century moment into the 20th century. And so I've been interested to see how across the 20th century, we see this increasing anxiety about men's bodies. We often think about women's bodies being held beneath a cultural microscope, to be thin, to restrain their appetites, to always aspire to an unreasonable sort of beauty ideal. But we see similar pressures being put upon men as the 20th century continues. And when we get to the 1990s, we start to see men's magazines like Men's Fitness, which were way more successful than they, you know, were initially anticipated to be, that there was this market for men interested in how to manage their bodies, what they were eating, as well as things, you know, like their sex life and what they should be reading.
So now let's bring food into the picture. I imagine that if there's a mayor of dude food with its notions of spidey, meaty excess, it has to be Guy Fieri. Explain how this next Food Network star became the poster boy for an untapped demographic in food media.
So he's referred, you know, from the beginning, right, as this dude chef with polarizing potential, but also a populist appeal. And so he does promote, right, what we would call dude food. I love Sam Sifton's definition. I also ended up defining dude food as sort of comfort food, but with an edge of competitive destruction, right? Whether the flavor profile is, you know, so exaggerated, it's almost uncomfortable to eat, or the portion sizes, the nutrition that's being put on the plate are so over the top. This is much more than just a cheeseburger, for example. And so I find dishes like Guy Fieri's, you know, trash can nachos, right? So perfectly emblematic of this definition of dude food, that these are nachos where every single chip, right, is just dripping with toppings. And then they're sort of prepared in a can and then, you know, pulled upward tableside. So these chips just sort of vomit out onto this plate. So it's this playful, ironic sort of pushing back, right, to any sort of standards of fine dining. And so with Guy Fieri, it's everything. It's the food that he promotes. It's his sartorial choices, right? The clothes that he wears, those sunglasses on the back of his head, that spiked bleach blonde hair. In every way, he's pushing back against these expectations of how an adult man should act, of who a food celebrity should be, and who counts as a celebrity chef on a network like Food Network. And so he comes at a moment when the network is trying to get more men to watch primetime TV about cooking and about food. And he proves this, you know, perfect example of how to diversify the gender of that primetime audience.
So Bloke Coke and Brogert, talk about gender-coded foods and how companies started developing products for men, which were traditionally perceived as diet foods for women.
Yes. So in the book, I'm really interested in yogurts, which had been perceived to be sort of feminine and feminized and had mostly in the United States been marketed to women and children. And then I also looked at diet sodas. But I look at this purposeful moment in the early 2000s and the 2010s when brands like Powerful Yogurt come out. So we're not going to just promote Greek yogurts, high protein, right? But it's also going to be in a much larger package. It is going to have a bull's head with the horns as its logo. It's going to have the tagline, "Find your inner abs." And just in case you can't, there's a six-pack literally chiseled into the plastic side of every container. And so thinking about how things like fonts, deep black colors were part of how both yogurts and diet sodas were marketed to men. And so that bloat Coke, I chuckled a little bit. When Coke Zero comes out in Australia, in the UK, it's very quickly sort of identified, right, as a joke of sort of bloat Coke, of this attempt to sell what's perceived to be a feminized food to men. And so that's the theme of what I'm looking at in the book. This isn't just how marketers go after men, because we know those tropes. We've seen those stereotypes. I was interested in how they had to construct a different idea of gender, how they had to use the dude specifically in this attempt to thwart what marketers call gender contamination, this idea that men won't buy products and brands that are perceived as feminine, whether it's Diet Coke or Activia yogurt, or to go on Weight Watchers, right? To buy a cookbook, to watch food TV. Those are the kinds of cases and attempts that I'm interested in looking at.
So as post-2016 America started to wrestle with misogyny, the Me Too movement, and now the pandemic, has the dude lost his footing? What's next?
So the dude was always a limited attempt, right? And I argue that he did quite a lot of damage in being applied to our food media world in the fact that he was endorsing these very binary, restricted, unimaginative understandings of what gender is, what it could be, and how it applies to different ideas about flavor, about foods, about appetite, about our bodies, about how we move through the world. And so he does start to lose his footing, particularly after 2016, when we are in these moments of huge, you know, toxic misogyny coming straight from the White House and reverberating right throughout our culture. At the same time that we see these increases in hate crimes, when we think about race, when we think about religion, that this was a moment of big cultural crisis. And so the dude, right, doesn't really make sense in a world where there hasn't been the transgender tipping point, that moment that we hoped for, to have true equitable representation, to have, you know, legal representation and support. But as we have these conversations, right, how can we continue to think that there are things like man food and lady drinks? So in the conclusion to the book, I track how every single brand, every product that I look at has changed their course, whether they've decided to extend the idea of the dude and his privilege slacking to everyone, or some of them have sort of stopped talking about gender. And so there are different directions where this can go, of how food media, in the way that we write about food, and food marketers, advertisers, how we attach ideas about gender to food. There's definitely change that we need to continue moving forward.
It's a fascinating book. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Emily Contois. We've been discussing gender-targeted marketing of food. Her book is Diners, Dudes, and Diets. The Market Report is up next. Stay close. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. I often think of spring as the start of pie season because the fruit is good. I mean, really, really good. Jillian Ferguson is at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week, where the berries and stone fruit are competing for our attention.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I'm at the Santa Monica Market this week with Zara Khan, who is the chef de cuisine at Botanica in Silver Lake. And Zara, after months of citrus, delicious citrus, we are now seeing the spring and even the summer fruit come into the market. There are cherries, blueberries, mulberries, and the strawberries really seem to be at their peak. So tell us what it is you're buying today and how all this fruit makes it on the menu at Botanica.
Hi. Okay, so I have a lot of fruit right now. There are some nectarines and peaches. I have white mulberries. I have cherries and, of course, strawberries. And so right now we are making a lot of jam because we work with Zero Grocery and do like our duca jams, granola cookies, stuff like that. So I'm like making and canning a lot of jam.
I saw that there was a strawberry sumac jam somewhere in the mix there. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, that I love because all our spices come from Villa Dorada, which is my friend in Seattle, Mehdi, who has, he's from Morocco and he started this import company with his family, and his spices are like unparalleled. So the sumac is from him, and I like to do a little nod to my heritage and sort of like the just direction of the restaurant. So instead of just doing like a straight ahead strawberry jam, I was like, well, how would it be if you added sumac, which is bright and a little bit citrusy and just like it pops. So that was nice.
So with the sumac, it has that tart kind of lemony tang to it. Yeah. Sometimes people do add lemon juice to jams. Yeah. Would you use the sumac in place of the lemon juice?
I use both. It's just like a little bit of lemon juice. I feel like the sumac definitely comes through more than the lemon would. And, you know, you cook it for so long that I think the lemon sort of gets very lost in the like jammy, deep strawberry flavor. And the sumac gives it that little high note that the lemon doesn't sustain.
It sounds so good. Would you also put sumac on fresh strawberries?
I definitely would do that. Yeah. I mean, like, we make all of our yogurt in-house, and I'm like, our date caraway granola with yogurt and, like, some strawberries and sumac, just, like, fresh. Once we get fully staffed up, then we have the bandwidth to do brunch. I have all these ideas churning, so,
That sounds so good. Yeah. So when someone is making strawberry jam, what is it that you're looking for? Can you kind of walk us through the process?
Yeah. I try to like type all the recipes at the shop, but some of the things I'm just like, you have to do it with your heart. You have to feel it. I always hull all the strawberries and then cut them in half. And then I will rinse them all, dump them into a pot, take sugar and a seed of vanilla bean, I guess is the words, and like rub that into the sugar to like infuse it. And then you just cook it low and slow for a long time. It's really just patience, honestly. Yeah, a lot of patience, a little bit of salt.
And are you canning this, or is this just for you guys at the restaurant?
We're canning some of it for Zero Grocery and for our market shelves. Zero Grocery is a zero waste, sustainable, they'll deliver to your door company here in LA, which I think is really cool. You know, at Botanica, we're like always trying to think about sustainability. So I'll can the stuff for them and for our market shelves. Then you don't have to worry about finding a place for it in the walk-in. and then I'll save a quart or two for our seasonal desserts usually. Yeah.
Great. Well, it's so nice to meet you, Zara. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Zara Khan, Chef de Cuisine of Botanica in Silver Lake. Their marketplace is open all day for pastry and coffees. And the patio is now open for dinner Wednesday through Sunday from 5 to 10 p.m. Harry's berries are probably the closest thing we have to a celebrity berry here at the market. The Jean family and their jewel-like strawberries have been featured in The New Yorker, The New York Times. They get shipped all over the world. And we are the fortunate ones who get to buy them practically at the source here at the market. Lexi Holton has known the Jean family since pretty much the day she was born, and she's been bringing these strawberries down from Oxnard to the Santa Monica market for the last 10 years. Hi, Lexi.
Hi.
So it's been a while since we've talked about Harry's berries on the Market Report, and I'd love to just get a refresher on what makes these berries so special. They are total showstoppers. They seem to be redder than all the other strawberries. The taste is extraordinary. How do you do it?
It's really just the farmer. We love growing strawberries. We try to be really good at it. It's also the soil in Oxnard is very rich and perfect for growing strawberries. We also grow specialty variety strawberries, strawberries that are meant for flavor. So we grow the Gaviotas, the Seascapes, and the Mara de Bois. They have an amazing flavor, and that's why we grow them.
What makes Harry's berries so unique is the flavor of the berries. Can you walk us through what the differences are in flavor between, for instance, the Gaviotas and the Seascapes and the Mara de Bois?
Yeah, so starting off with Gaviotas. Gaviotas are a low acid variety. That's what's going to make them very sweet. They're very sweet and juicy. The Mara de Bois are also sweet, but they're going to have more of a Concord grape flavor. Some people tell us they taste like lavender or wine or roses, rosé. We get that a lot. And then we also have the other variety, Seascapes. Seascapes are a little bit higher in acid. They're great for baking, especially if you're going to be adding sugar to your recipes anyways. They're really good for that because they have a really nice strawberry flavor.
They really are so unique. I always tell people that if you want to know what the strawberry Jolly Rancher flavor comes from, just go eat a Harry's Berry. So it seems that strawberry production has really ramped up. You've been bringing more and more to the market. Are we in peak strawberry season right now?
Yes, May is peak season for us, or at least for all of Oxnard. That's even when Oxnard has its strawberry festival, just because there's so many strawberries and nobody knows what to do with. So yeah, May is peak season.
And how long do these strawberries last once we get them home from the market?
It depends on the time in the season. Right now, they'll last you like at least 5 days. And there's a special way to keep them too, we usually say. Transfer them into an airtight container, like a Tupperware, and then layer it with dry paper towels on the top, in between, and underneath them. And don't wash them until you're about to eat them. You can get almost 2 weeks out of them that way.
Wow, okay, great. Thank you for all this, Lexi.
Yeah, sure, no problem.
That was Lexi Holton. She and the Jean family bring Harry's Berries down from Oxnard to 18 markets in Southern California, including the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica and Sunday Hollywood markets. For The Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Masiha, and John Meek. Before we wrap up today's show, I want to say how lucky I am to get to do what I do. I've always said I'm a bookworm, a total voyeur, and because of KCRW, I get to channel my inner nerd into fascinating conversations every week. If you value KCRW as much as I do, then please consider becoming a member today. So much has changed this past year, but if KCRW remains a part of your daily life, then give now. Join KCRW and contribute to a better tomorrow. Just go to kcrw.com/give. And thank you. You are our raison d'etre, and we literally couldn't do it without you. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.